I think the trouble starts at the beginning, when I'm supposed to direct loving-kindness toward myself. In any event, I'm happy to say that for me, non-meta meditation, plain vanilla mindfulness meditation, has some of the effect that meta meditation is supposed to have. It tamps down my ill will and can even amp up my empathy. In fact, once during a meditation retreat, after nearly a week of extensive mindfulness meditation, I thought about the person who is among my two or three most bitter enemies in the whole world, a former colleague of mine, let's call him Larry, whom I never found very collegial, to say the least. Normally, if I see Larry, or even think of him, I perceive a kind of bad vibe aura, essence of Larry, you might call it. But on that retreat, I started to think about him without that aura. I saw his most obnoxious behaviors, or at least the behaviors I find most obnoxious, as manifestations of insecurity. I vividly imagined him as the gangly, unathletic adolescent he likely was, imagined him not getting any respect on the playground, trying to find his identity, and finally settling on an identity that, as it happens, has rubbed me the wrong way. And for that moment, I felt a kind of compassion for him. What I didn't feel was essence. At least, I didn't perceive the essence of Larry that I had always perceived before. And I think this was the key. Breaking down the old essence of Larry allowed me to then conceive a new version of Larry that was closer to the truth. The 13th century Sufi poet Rumi is said to have written, "Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it." It turns out there's some question as to whether Rumi did write that, but anyway, if he did, I think he was on to something. To be sure, it would be an exaggeration to say that knocking down the barrier I faced, namely the essence of Larry that my mind had painstakingly constructed over the years, led me to love Larry. Still, I did feel for a moment some measure of the kind of empathy a parent feels when viewing a young son or daughter trying and failing to fit in socially. Of course, that feeling passed. But I think there was a lasting impact. The next time I saw Larry, I shook hands with him and exchanged greetings, and for the first time in a long time, didn't feel like I was faking it. At least, I didn't feel like I was 100% faking. It was somewhere in the 40 to 50% range. On the same meditation retreat that led me to see a weed that lacked essence of weed, I also had an interesting encounter with a reptile. I was walking through the woods and, looking down, saw a lizard frozen in its tracks, presumably by the sight of me. As I watched it look around nervously and calculate its next move, my first thought was that the lizard's behavior was governed by a relatively simple algorithm. See large creature, freeze. If creature approaches, run. But then I realized that though my own behavioral algorithms are much more complicated than that, there could well be a being so intelligent that, to it, I looked as simple-minded as the lizard looks to me. The more I thought about it, the more that lizard and I seemed to have in common. We were both thrown into a world we didn't choose, under the guidance of behavioral algorithms we didn't choose, and were trying to make the best of the situation. I felt a kind of kinship with the lizard that I'd never felt with a lizard. As with my burst of compassion for Larry, my sense of kinship with this lizard didn't require loving-kindness meditation. Mindfulness meditation itself, practiced diligently, tends to expand your understanding of other organisms, and I mean understanding, not just in the mushy sense of peace, love, and understanding, but also, in fact mainly, in the sense of having a clearer comprehension of the organism. I was looking at that lizard the way a visitor from Mars might look at it, with interest and curiosity, and fewer distorting preconceptions than I normally bring to such things. I think the reason I could look at that lizard with so little in the way of preconceptions is because I didn't see essence of lizard, or at least didn't see as much of it as I usually see. In fact, you might say that not seeing essence and not having preconceptions are one and the same, because the essence we perceive in things is a preconception about them that has been programmed into our brain. These preconceptions typically get us to react to things in ways that are in some sense expedient, but not necessarily in ways that involve a true understanding of them. Expediency has its virtues, of course. It can be expedient in a good way to know that your spouse is your spouse. So I wouldn't recommend relinquishing your sense of essence as thoroughly as Fred, the victim of Cap Gras delusion mentioned in the previous chapter. But that's not something you have to worry about anyway. I'm not aware of any meditators having taken things that far, not even those who seem to have gotten somewhere in the vicinity of enlightenment. Fred was useful in illustrating the link between essence and affect, but he's not useful in illustrating where the Dharma leads. Still, he does raise an interesting question about where the Dharma can lead, even if it isn't going to lead you to where Fred was, to a point where you see so little essence that you can't figure out who is who. Is it possible that it could lead you too far? Suppose, for example, that though you can still accurately identify your spouse as your spouse, you see less essence of spouse than you used to. And suppose your feelings change accordingly. Will that mean you love your spouse less deeply now? Or to take another example, will parents who meditate intensively come to love their offspring less intensely? Indeed, doesn't the whole Buddhist idea that you should let go of your attachments encourage, in some sense, less parental love, as we've always known parental love? If you ask the average meditation teacher a question like this, you'll hear something to the effect that, no, meditative practice won't negate your love or even subdue it, but may change its nature. Maybe, for example, parental love will become less possessive, and, who knows, maybe that will produce a happier parent and a happier child than a more anxious, more controlling kind of love would produce. For practical purposes, that's a fair answer. So far as I can tell, enhanced personal relationships with kin and with non-kin are a much more likely result of meditative practice than the opposite. But suppose some meditation teacher, in response to this question about the prospect of diminished love, gave a less reassuring answer. Yes, if you meditate a whole lot, there's a chance that the actual magnitude of your love for your offspring will drop a bit. Would that scenario really be such a horrible one? Imagine a world in which affluent American parents showered slightly less devotion and concern on their children. And imagine they spent the time saved thinking about children who don't have parents at all and asking what they could do to help them. Would that be so bad? It's great that natural selection gave us the capacity for love and compassion and altruism, but that doesn't mean we have to accept natural selection's guidance on how to allocate these precious resources. I want to emphasize how hypothetical this is, this imagined trade-off between attention to the welfare of kin and of non-kin. The upshot of the standard, more reassuring answer to the question about diminished love is generally true. Don't worry, your family relationships will, on balance, be enriched as you follow the Dharma, even if, maybe especially if, you follow it a long way. Still, I don't want to gloss over this important point. From a moral perspective, the effect of your meditation practice on the people you already love isn't necessarily the only or even the central issue. There's a second moral question lurking here. What if meditation didn't lead you to allocate your compassion differently and perhaps more equitably, but somehow distanced you from feelings of compassion altogether, leaving you indifferent to the welfare of people broadly? After all, If meditation can drain things like hatred and resentment of motivating force, why couldn't it have a symmetrically subduing effect on the other side of the ledger? It could, and the fact that it tends not to is in a way puzzling. But tends not to doesn't mean never does, and this point is worth dwelling on. Taking some of the essence out of things is likely to make you a better person, but it's not guaranteed to make you a better person. Like the meditative path more generally, it can give you a perspective that is in some sense more detached and can thus make self-control easier. But the world is full of horrible people who can summon detachment and self-control. Indeed, detachment and self-control have helped some of them become more adroitly horrible. There have been meditation teachers of great contemplative prowess who sexually exploited psychologically vulnerable students, including a famous teacher in Manhattan who became known as the Zen Predator of the Upper East Side. It may even be that some of them, by viewing incipient pangs of guilt mindfully, eased internal resistance to their misbehavior. The two-edged nature of meditative mastery underscores the value of supplementing Buddhist meditation with moral instruction. That's not exactly an original insight on my part. When the Buddha laid out the path to liberation, the eightfold path that is unveiled in the last of the Four Noble Truths, moral precepts occupied a big place in it. The idea wasn't that intensive meditation would by itself bring enlightenment in all its dimensions. Still, meditation is a crucial part of the program. One reason is that, as we'll explore more fully in Chapter 15, the insights into the nature of being that it fosters, including the apprehension of emptiness, do tend to bring moral insight, even if the link between meditating and becoming a better person isn't fully automatic. Another reason is that meditation can be used to cultivate virtues that counter our less laudatory tendencies. Though I've already admitted to not having a natural facility for loving-kindness meditation, I haven't given up on it, and I encourage everyone to try it. Party time. Enough sermonizing. Let's have some fun. Or can we? Another commonly raised concern about the Dharma is that it could take the joy out of life. This question came up in a discussion I had with Bhikkhu Bodhi, an American Buddhist monk who is well known in scholarly circles for having translated reams of Buddhist texts into English. He is an exceedingly friendly man with a shaved head, one of the largest smiles I've ever seen, and a pronounced tendency to use it, often in the course of laughing. One of my daughters, after watching a video of my interview with him, said, "I want him to be my uncle." During that interview, I was, as is my wont, trying to get some first-hand corroboration for my pet theory that seeing emptiness, in other words, not seeing essence, consists largely of feeling less intensely toward things. I started by saying, when we bring interpretation to something and thereby attribute essence to it, some of that interpretation involves how we feel about it. So my enemy is a bad person. My home is a warm, cozy place. Part of the essence I'm attributing to things is coming from my feelings, right? He said, "Exactly, exactly." I then babbled a little about how, if you're seriously pursuing liberation and trying to divorce yourself from the cravings and aversions that most of us have, then naturally things in the world wouldn't have strong emotional connotations, and that might be part of your perception that they lack essence. This time, his assent didn't come so readily. After a long pause, he said, "If one takes that too literally, one might come away with the idea that the ultimate aim of Buddhism is to become a completely unemotional, emotionally flat, emotionally deprived automaton." At this point, one of his epic smiles erupted. He started laughing as he said, "As my mother used to say, As far as I'm concerned, between an enlightened Buddhist and a vegetable, there's no difference. He reared his head back and laughed for a full 5 seconds before continuing to quote his mother. "Is this why you become a Buddhist monk? To become a vegetable?" Then he got serious again. "But I would say that in my opinion, my experience, as one continues to practice the Buddhist path, it enriches the emotional life, so that one becomes emotionally more sensitive, more happy and joyful. And I would say that one can respond to things in the world in a freer, more happy, more delightful way." Makes sense to me. After all, one virtue of mindfulness meditation is that experiencing your feelings with care and clarity, rather than following them reflexively and uncritically, lets you choose which ones to follow, like, say, joy, delight, and love. And this selective engagement with feelings, this weakened obedience to them, can in principle include the feelings that shape the essence we see in things and people. I pressed Bhikkhu Bodhi a bit further on this affect and essence business. I said, "Doesn't part of the freedom come from the fact that you are not attaching these judgmental, affective connotations to things? In other words, not attributing essence so strongly to things can be a source of freedom." Nodding his head emphatically, he said, "Definitely." 13. Like, wow, everything is one, at most. Recounting experiences you've had while meditating is a delicate business. They're most worth recounting if they're unusual, but if they're too unusual, people look at you like you're crazy. I once had an experience that I hope falls in the sweet spot, weird enough to get people's attention, not so weird that they notify local authorities. It was the fourth or fifth day of a meditation retreat. I was sitting on my cushion, legs crossed, eyes closed as usual. I wasn't making a point of focusing on any one kind of thing, not particularly on sounds, not particularly on emotions, not particularly on physical sensations. My field of awareness seemed wide open. My attention moved easily from one part of it to another, resting lightly on each new perch, and meanwhile, a sense of the whole remained. At one point I felt a tingling in my foot. At roughly the same time, I heard a bird singing outside. And here's the odd thing. I felt that the tingling in my foot was no more a part of me than the singing of the bird. You may ask, was I feeling that the singing of the bird was actually a part of me? Or was I feeling that the tingling in my foot wasn't a part of me? To put a less fine point on it, did I feel like I was at one with the world, or was I closer to feeling like I was nothing? If you are indeed asking these questions, you've hit on a fascinating philosophical issue that highlights a contrast between different strands of Buddhist thought, and that, more fundamentally, divides mainstream Buddhist philosophy from mainstream Hindu philosophy. But you're probably not asking these questions. You're more likely to be asking whether I'm crazy. So I'll address that question first, and get to the deep philosophical questions later. For starters, let me emphasize that if this experience makes me crazy, I'm in good company. I've had several chances to describe the experience to truly accomplished meditators, some of them monks, some of them famous meditation teachers, and invariably, they've recognized the kind of experience I'm describing as one they've had. What's more, it's a kind of experience that, they tend to believe, is very important. Indeed, I might go so far as to say that this is the central experience of Buddhism. Not central in the sense of most profound or most important, but rather central in the place it occupies in the landscape of Buddhist philosophy. The place where Buddhism's two fundamental, crazy-sounding but arguably valid concepts, not self and emptiness, come together. It's a kind of grand, unifying, meditative experience. Before explaining what I mean by that, I should try to put a little more flesh on the experience itself. First, I should stress that Any sense of continuity I felt between myself and the bird doing the singing wasn't really about the bird in particular. It wasn't like the feeling I had toward the lizard in the previous chapter, when I realized that the lizard and I had more in common than I'd previously appreciated. It was less cognitive than that, and more purely perceptual. It was a kind of dissolving of the perceived boundary between me and the rest of the world generally. In other words, this was an apprehension, not a conclusion. It's not like I had become convinced via some logical argument that a bird's song is no less a part of me than my foot's tingling. Still, in the wake of this experience, I started to think that maybe there is an argument of this sort that you could make. It would start something like this. How much difference is there, really, between feeling my foot tingle and hearing a bird sing? In both cases, the perception seems to register somewhere inside my head, at some kind of center of consciousness, which means that in both cases, the perception requires that information be transmitted to my head from a remote location. My foot transmits information about a tingling. The bird transmits information about a song. What's the difference? The obvious rejoinder is, but the tingling originates inside your skin. It's part of you. Well, yes, it's inside my skin. But the whole question I'm raising is whether my skin is really as significant a boundary as we instinctively assume, whether it really makes sense to think of everything on the inside as me and everything on the outside as other. So you can't just reiterate that instinctive assumption and put my question to rest. If that tactic were considered fair, no assumptions would ever be overthrown. Another rejoinder you could make is, but tinglings and other bodily sensations tend to come with deep, inherent, affective qualities. A pain in your foot, for example, is inherently painful. A bird song, on the other hand, is a matter of taste, pleasant to some, annoying to others. The problem with this objection is that pain isn't inherently painful. I've already recounted the time that, via meditation, I converted an excruciating knot of anxiety into a mere object of interest, and the time meditation made waves of acute tooth pain kind of beautiful. And there was another time when, by changing my perspective toward modest lower back pain, I turned it into a mildly pleasant sensation. Granted, this transformation of lemons into lemonade isn't routine. It's the kind of thing that's easier to do on retreat when I'm immersed in the meditative lifestyle than when I'm back in the real world, saying things like, "It's such a pain that my back causes me pain." And to go even further than this in the reconceptualization of pain, to achieve the mindset of that Vietnamese Buddhist monk who immolated himself without flinching, would take much deeper immersion. But the point is that such immersion is possible, and it undermines the easy claim that internally originating sensations have fixed meanings, whereas externally originating ones don't. Besides, if the key criterion for whether something is part of myself is how close to automatic my interpretation of the signals it sends are, then what about the case of offspring? My daughters don't reside within my skin, yet when I see one of them in pain, it causes me to suffer as reliably as my own pain does. The great American psychologist William James wrote, "Between what a man calls me and what he simply calls mine, the line is difficult to draw." In that sense, he observed, our immediate family is a part of ourselves. Our father and mother, our wife and babes, our bone of our bone and flesh of our flesh. When they die, a part of our very selves is gone. Evolution and the bounds of self. If you ask why kin have this near-self property, the answer is that we were created by a particular process that embodies certain values. Actually, it seems to embody one value, the successful transmission of genetic material through the generations. Since close kin share many of our genes, taking care of them makes sense from natural selection's point of view. So genes for familial empathy and familial love, and for a host of related feelings, such as familial guilt, have flourished. In other words, our instinctive definition of what is us and what is ours is a product of the particular rules by which a particular creative process known as natural selection works. It's not impossible, by the way, that our species could have taken an evolutionary path that would have left us with feelings toward some birds that are reminiscent of our feelings toward kin. When two species have a form of symbiotic relationship, known as mutualism, that is, they help each other, they can evolve warm feelings that sustain that relationship. Dogs seem to have co-evolved with human beings, and that may help account for the fact that I've been accused by my children of loving our dogs as much as I love my children. I vigorously deny this allegation, but it's true that if my dogs are in pain, I, in some sense, feel that pain. Symbiosis can also sponsor a different kind of relationship that calls into question the bounds of self. We have a symbiotic relationship with various kinds of bacteria that reside within us and that in various ways influence our moods and thoughts. Scientists have found that by replacing the gut bacteria in shy, anxious mice with bacteria from gregarious mice, they can make the shy mice gregarious. For ethical reasons, this kind of experiment isn't done on humans, but other evidence makes it clear that in our species too, microbes influence the mind, in part by influencing neurotransmitters. In fact, maybe it's not too much of a stretch to say that the bacteria, kind of like that bird at the meditation retreat, send signals to my brain, even if the bacteria send their signals more subtly. So if I routinely consider signals that are ultimately traceable to bacteria, part of me, why can't I consider signals sent by a bird, part of me? Especially given that, had evolution taken a different path, involving mutualistic symbiosis between humans and that species of bird, such signals might routinely seem more like part of me. The generic point I'm trying to make is this. Lots of information impinges on my brain, and my brain decides which information it will consider part of myself and which information it won't consider part of myself, and which information, say the cry of an offspring, falls somewhere in between. And I take it for granted that those decisions comport with some deep metaphysical truth about what is I and what is other. But in fact, my brain could have been wired in a different way, so that it interpreted this information differently, leaving me with a very different sense of the distinction between I and other. For example, people with a condition known as mirror touch synesthesia pretty literally share the feelings of people in their vicinity. If they see someone being touched, they feel the touch, and brain scans show much the same neuronal activity that they would have if they were being touched. You can imagine a process for creating organic beings, either natural selection operating under quirky conditions or some process other than natural selection, that would make mirror-touch synesthesia the norm rather than an aberration, in which case the prevailing conception of what self means would be very different. But we're getting ahead of the story. The question of how our view of the world might differ if the process that created us had taken a different turn here or there, or had been a different kind of process altogether, is one I'll explore more deeply in Chapter 15. For now, the point is that what things we identify with and how closely we identify with them, things both inside our skin and outside our skin, is to no small extent the result of the path that human evolution did, as a matter of fact, take. Our intuitive conception of ourself and its bounds is, in that sense, arbitrary. I suppose I could go further in trying to defend the validity of the experience I had at that retreat, but there's not much point in persisting, because it's not as if I think I have some killer argument that would convince you that a bird's song is part of me. In fact, it's not as if I myself go around believing that bird songs are part of me. I'm mainly just trying to convince you that the perception I had isn't as crazy as it may have sounded, and that's about all I can do. Attempts to truly share the experience with you will ultimately fail. As with all mystical experiences, you had to be there. Anyway, whatever you think of my little birdsong moment, one takeaway from it is that what I've been calling the not-self experience actually has two sides. Earlier in this book, I talked about what you could call the interior version of the experience. This consists of looking within at your thoughts, your feelings, and asking, wait a second, in what sense are these things really inherently a part of me? This is the basic question that was asked by the Buddha in his famous discourse on not-self. But there is also what you could call the exterior not-self experience. This consists of looking at the outside world, at things beyond your skin, and asking, in what sense are these things not a part of me? In other words, instead of asking whether the supposed contents of the self are really contents of the self, you're asking whether the supposed bounds of the self are really bounds of the self. In one case, you're questioning your intuition that you should identify with pretty much everything inside you, such as feelings of pointless anxiety. And in the other case, you're questioning your intuition that you shouldn't identify with much of anything outside you. In my experience, the first question can lead to the second question. One reason it was hard to see a clear line between the tingling in my foot and the singing of the bird is that I wasn't identifying very closely with the tingling in the first place. The disaggregation of my self made its contents seem more like the contents of the world beyond me. The diffuseness of my self made its bounds less distinct. In that sense, there's something like a logical progression connecting the interior and exterior versions of the not-self experience. But if there's a kind of logic here, there's also a kind of paradox. After all, the less sense it makes to talk about a you inside your skin, the less sense it would seem to make to talk about your continuity with the outside world. And if you take the orthodox Buddhist position that it ultimately makes no sense to talk about a you inside your skin, then the idea of your continuity with the outside world would seem to make no sense either. Here we return to the question I sidestepped at the beginning of this chapter. When the boundary between foot and bird, between interior tingling and exterior singing, got fuzzy, did I feel like I was at one with the world, or did I feel like I was nothing? As if there was nothing in here to be at one with the stuff out there. There are at least two reasons I'm reluctant to answer that question. One is that, to be honest, I'm not sure the experience I had aligns neatly with either option. The other reason for my reluctance is that the way you answer that question can land you in the middle of a big argument between Buddhist thinkers and Hindu thinkers, and for that matter, a big argument between one kind of Buddhist thinker and another kind. My inadvertent online controversy. This was driven home to me shortly after I launched an online course called Buddhism and Modern Psychology, an adaptation of a course I had been teaching at Princeton University. One challenge in making the adaptation was that the on-campus version of the course had benefited from guest speakers, ranging from brain scientists to very serious meditators. I decided to create something like that experience for my online students with digital video. I had dialogues with brain scientists and serious meditators on a website I run called bloggingheads.tv, and I wove excerpts of the videos into my online lectures. One excerpt started something of a controversy in the course's discussion forum. The excerpt featured Gary Weber, whom we met in Chapter 11. He's the one who participated in that Yale brain scan study, and whose default mode network, it turned out, was inordinately quiet, even when he wasn't meditating. In my bloggingheads.tv dialogue with Weber, I asked him about a line of his I recalled reading, something to the effect of, "The bad news is that you don't exist. The good news is that you're everything. Elaborating on that passage, Weber said to me, "If you're nothing, if you disappear, you can then be everything. But you can't be everything unless you are nothing. It just logically follows that's the case." Well, I'm not sure it logically follows, but apparently it seems like inexorable logic if you're in the state Weber is in. He continued, "If you are nothing, instead of just disappearing and becoming a void, you find out that in some strange way, you actually see this, you perceive it this way, that everything is all one thing." This is a cliché, mystical statement, but it really is perceptible. You can deeply sense that everything is all one thing, and somehow, strangely, it's inside of you. It didn't take long for Weber's comments to get blowback in the discussion forum. Some of the blowback was the kind you'd expect, people finding the paradox at the heart of Weber's experience inscrutable, if not worse. One student wrote, "I am nothing means I am everything is pretentious twaddle, which actually means I am on such a high spiritual plane that you can't possibly understand me." Other students objected not to the paradox itself, but to the second half of it, the "I am everything" part. One student, a meditation teacher herself, wrote, "Buddhist philosophy does not espouse oneness." And she was basically right. Though you can certainly find respected Buddhist thinkers who will put things roughly the way Weber did, you won't find this idea of the oneness of everything in the mainstream of Mahayana Buddhist philosophy, the philosophy that so emphasizes the idea of emptiness. After all, if the things we see in the world out there are in fact empty of essence, then in a sense, they don't exist, at least not as things per se. And of course the self, according to Buddhist philosophy, doesn't exist. So how could everything, a bunch of things out there that don't really, strictly speaking, exist, and a self in here that doesn't really, strictly speaking, exist, all be one? Nothing plus nothing adds up to nothing, not one, right? That's a simplified, almost cartoonish version of the actual Buddhist argument. But it captures the spirit of the argument and helps explain why Orthodox Buddhists would bridle at loose talk of oneness. On the other hand, once you go beyond the caricature and look a bit more deeply at the mainstream argument, you start to wonder whether the bridling is really in order. In fact, pondering the student's reaction to Weber led me to believe that the line between the ideas of emptiness and oneness is pretty fuzzy. Emptiness, oneness. What's the diff? If you look at the logic marshaled by Buddhist philosophers on behalf of the doctrine of emptiness, you'll see that it has much to do with a Buddhist idea that's often rendered in English as interdependent co-arising. This basically means that things which may seem to exist independently of other things are in fact dependent for their existence and their character on other things. Trees need sunlight and water, and indeed are continually being changed by these and other things they come into contact with. Streams and lakes and oceans need rain, and the rain needs the streams and lakes and oceans. People need air, and the air around them wouldn't have the composition it has if people weren't inhaling it and exhaling into it. In other words, nothing possesses inherent existence. Nothing contains all the ingredients of ongoing existence within itself. Nothing is self-sufficient. Hence the idea of emptiness. All things are empty of inherent, independent existence. This, according to Buddhist philosophy, is the fact about reality that you are intuitively apprehending if, through extended meditation, you come to feel that things lack essence. And if, at the same time, you feel the bounds of yourself start to dissolve, then you're just experiencing a larger expanse of emptiness, an emptiness that pervades not just all supposed things out there, but also the supposed self in here. This helps explain why, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, the not-self doctrine is sometimes depicted as just a special case of the broader doctrine of emptiness. By way of underscoring this pervasiveness of emptiness, Buddhist philosophers sometimes apply the term not-self to things out there as well as things in here. Just as you lack self, trees also lack self, and so do rocks. Or if you want to switch the terminology, just as trees and rocks lack essence, you lack essence. Either way, it's emptiness everywhere you look. At least, that's the argument. But it seems to me you could flip this Buddhist argument around to make the case that the ideas of pervasive emptiness and of oneness aren't really as different as they sound. The hinge for the flipping is the term at the center of the argument, interdependent co-arising. Interdependence is a much-used term these days. You might, for example, track the stock markets in several countries, notice that they tend to be correlated, and say, wow, there's more interdependence among these economies than I had realized. And here the second part of that Buddhist term, co-arising, would also be apt. After all, none of these economies would have become what they are had they not been interacting with the other economies. Now if, after noting this interdependence, you added, there's more unity among these economies than I had realized, most people would consider that a reasonable thing to say. A bunch of highly interdependent systems is closer to unity than a bunch of non-interdependent systems. Indeed, one reason an organism is thought of as unified is that there is so much interdependence among its parts, kidneys, lungs, and so on. So it seems kind of strange to object to someone describing an apprehension of unity or oneness by saying, no, no, you're completely wrong. It's actually interdependence and interconnection, not unity or oneness. Doesn't interdependence and interconnection point to unity and oneness? I mean, they're not exactly the same thing. But isn't it fair to say that the more interdependence and interconnection there is, the closer you are to oneness? And aren't people who espouse the doctrine of emptiness basically saying that reality is pervaded by interdependence and interconnection? It's almost enough to make you wonder why some people get upset when someone like Weber talks about oneness rather than pervasive emptiness. Why get indignant when somebody takes an arguably defensible position on a somewhat obscure semantic question? But the philosophical stakes are greater than you might think. And here we come to the aforementioned clash between Buddhist and Hindu philosophy. In Hindu thought, specifically within a Hindu school of thought known as Advaita Vedanta, there is the idea that the individual self or soul is actually just a part of what you might call a universal soul. To put the proposition in Hindu terminology, Atman, the self or soul, is Brahman, the universal soul. Now, to say that Atman is anything at all, Brahman, whatever, is to say that Atman exists in the first place. And the very birth of Buddhism, its distinct emergence within an otherwise Hindu milieu, is thought to lie largely in the denial that Atman exists. So you can see why bringing Gary Weber into a course on Buddhism might get me into trouble. To say that everything is all one thing is, by philosophical implication, to say that the self exists, which in turn is to suggest that, among Eastern philosophies, Buddhism isn't so special after all. But here's the funny thing. Weber had actually denied that the self exists. He had explicitly tied his sense that you are everything to his sense that you are nothing. Indeed, a later part of the video dialogue reinforced that link. In it, I said to Weber, I have had a meditative experience where the bounds of myself in a certain sense suddenly seemed more permeable. That is, like the place where the bird's song enters my sensory apparatus no longer seemed like such a fine dividing line. Exactly, he replied. I continued, but that was like a one-time, brief experience. You're saying that as you walk around every day, you in a way identify with everyone else as much as you identify with yourself? Yeah, I'd say it's a little different from that, but not far different. I don't identify with anything. I mean, there's nobody here to identify with me or with anyone else. It's just an empty, still presence here inside my body, which is there, beyond my body. I said, so the problem with saying you identify with everyone is that first word, you. Exactly, because there's no you there to do the identifying. How can he talk this way, so paradoxically, and in a language that isn't fully Buddhist or fully Hindu? Well, as for the paradox part, as I suggested near the outset of this book, if you don't like paradox, maybe Eastern philosophy isn't for you. And, as I also suggested, neither is quantum physics. As for Weber's refusal to talk like a doctrinaire Buddhist or a doctrinaire Hindu, having studied for years in the Vedanta tradition and for years in Buddhist traditions, he's not wed to any particular philosophy. So when he has a meditative experience, he's not bound by allegiance to interpret it in any one way. He just tells you how it feels. And how it feels seems to put him right on the border between Buddhist philosophy and Hindu philosophy. He'll say one thing that tilts toward the Buddhist side and one that tilts toward the Hindu side, which makes a kind of sense if the claim I made earlier is right. If there's really not much difference between saying that things are so interconnected and interdependent as to lack individual identity, and saying that things are so interconnected and interdependent as to be a single thing. This suggests an interesting possibility. Maybe the deepest meditative experiences had by Buddhists and the deepest meditative experiences had by Hindus in the Advaita Vedanta tradition are basically the same experience. There is a sense of dissolution of the bounds of self and an ensuing sense of continuity with the world out there. If you're Buddhist, at least a Buddhist of the mainstream type, you're encouraged to think of that as a continuity of emptiness, and if you're a Hindu, you're encouraged to think of it as a continuity of soul or spirit. For that matter, maybe some Abrahamic mystics, Christians, Jews, Muslims, who during contemplative practice feel a union with the divine, are having somewhat the same experience as the Hindus and Buddhists, and interpreting it in a way that is closer to the Hindu than the Buddhist perspective. The core experiences remain the same, but the doctrinal articulation varies. And actually, maybe the articulations aren't as different as they seem. Both the Hindus and the Buddhists, and in a sense even the Abrahamic mystics, are saying that our ordinary conception of the self as this distinct, sovereign thing is in some sense illusory. We feel a boundary that is not ultimately as real as we think, and moving toward the ultimate truth involves the dissolution of that boundary. Anyway, my basic view of religious beliefs is that the ultimate question isn't their specific content, but rather, what kind of person do the beliefs make you? How do they lead you to behave? There is reason to think that this basic Buddhist-Hindu idea, that the bounds of self aren't really bounds, can lead to good behavior. I once asked Judson Brewer, who conducted the Yale study that Weber participated in and is himself a very committed meditator, whether, if everyone in the world meditated intensively, there would be any wars. He answered with a question, why would someone want to harm themselves? In that sense, I don't think there would be. Because it's like, why would you cut off your right hand? Weber himself put it this way, if everything is one thing, then why should I do something, if there was an I there to do it, to perturb this? Why should I do something bad to you? I agree with Weber. He shouldn't do something bad to me. In fact, I even agree in principle that I shouldn't do something bad to him or to other people. The problem is that for me, this is just an abstract belief, not a deeply experientially grounded intuition in the sense that I suspect it is for him, which may help explain why I don't always abide by it, And apparently, if I'm going to feel this intuition as strongly as he feels it, or as strongly as Brewer feels it, I'm going to have to log another, 10,000 hours of meditation. And life is short. Fortunately, there's a way that, without meditating 3 hours a day for 10 years, I can get some idea of what kind of person that might make me. One great thing about meditation retreats is that, through total, if temporary, immersion, they give you a fleeting glimpse of what it might be like to live life as a really serious meditator. And I've gotten some sense on retreats of the connection between the not-self experience and being a better person. The time I didn't kill a man who was snoring. Consider my feelings toward a guy at a meditation retreat I went on in December 2013. He was sitting a few rows in front of me, falling asleep as I sat there meditating. You may ask, if I had my eyes closed, how did I know he was falling asleep? Because he was snoring. When you're trying to meditate, snoring can get on your nerves, especially when you're not the one doing the snoring. Indeed, I noticed in my lower abdomen a feeling of wrath toward this man. Actually, at first, I didn't really notice it. I just felt it and reflexively obeyed it, thinking the kinds of thoughts such feelings are designed to make us think, such as, "Who is this jerk?" I felt a strong urge to open my eyes so that I could identify the culprit, the better, I suppose, to bring him to justice at some later date. But then, finally, I did what you're supposed to do in mindfulness meditation. Observe whatever feelings you're having. And at that point, I really did notice the wrath. I looked right at it. And after only a few seconds of clear observation, it completely dissolved. It was as if my attention was a killer laser beam, and this feeling of wrath was an enemy spaceship. Zap! Gone. So what exactly does my wrath-zapping experience have to do with the not-self experience? Two things, actually. One of them, kind of obvious and having to do with the interior version of the not-self experience, and one of them subtler and having to do with the exterior version. Here's the obvious interior part. When I looked at my wrath mindfully, I was ceasing to identify with it, ceasing to own it. A feeling that had seemed a part of me, that had been so deeply ingrained in me that I was mindlessly obeying it, now seemed like something else, like an object to be observed. Once I trained my attention on it, even before it dissolved in the face of that attention, it effectively ceased to be part of me. Granted, this wasn't a very thoroughgoing version of the interior, not-self experience. I had only disowned a single feeling on a single occasion, slightly shrinking the scope of myself. Still, it was something, and it made me briefly a better person, a person no longer contemplating homicide. As for the subtler sense in which this was a not-self experience, the sense in which it was an exterior not-self experience, well, this takes some explaining. Specifically, it takes explaining the work of Miri Albahari. Albahari is an Australian philosopher whose work on Buddhist philosophy is informed partly by the practice of meditation. But in keeping with her nearly compulsive humility, she emphasizes that she is not a skilled meditator. During a long meditation retreat, she says, she can get to the point where she feels less self, but not to the point where she feels no self. And in between retreats, she doesn't always manage to sustain a daily practice, though when she does, she says, her life goes noticeably better. In her book, Analytical Buddhism, Albahari makes an argument that brings us back to the Buddha's first discourse after his enlightenment, the famous Sermon at Deer Park. Here the Buddha lays out the four noble truths which explain the cause of dukkha, of suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and the cure. He says that the basic cause of dukkha is tanha, a word usually translated as thirst or craving, and sometimes as desire. To put a finer point on it, the problem is the unquenchability of tanha, the fact that attaining our desires always leaves us unsatisfied, thirsting for more of the same, or thirsting for something new. Al-Bukhari says that tanha is inextricably tied to the sensation of self, and that overcoming tanha is therefore tied to the experience of not-self. She's not just talking about the interior version of the not-self experience. She's not just saying that if you let go of a particular desire, then you have disowned it, so that part of yourself disappears. She's saying that tanha is deeply involved in your sense that the self is bounded. Tanha sustains and strengthens the sense of boundedness that, during the exterior not-self experience, weakens. After all, she says, if you thirst for something, hot chocolate, say, then you are painfully aware of the gap between yourself and that chocolate, and that means you have a conception of the bounds of yourself. Indeed, as I sit here thinking about that particular thirst being quenched, I do imagine some of those bounds. I imagine the surface of my hand making contact with the mug of chocolate, and the surface of my tongue making contact with the chocolate itself. To see the full breadth of the argument Al-Bukhari is making, you have to understand that, like many scholars, she considers tanha to include not just the desire for things you find pleasant, sex, chocolate, a new car, a newer car. It also includes the desire to be free of things you find unpleasant. In other words, tanha fuels not just attraction to alluring things, but also aversion to off-putting things. In this view, my annoyance at the snoring in the meditation hall was tanha. It was a desire to be free of the snoring noise. Well, Al-Bukhari says, if you desire to be free of something, then you have in mind the goal of creating more distance between yourself and that something, assuming you don't take the more straightforward approach of throwing a meditation cushion at the person generating the something. And wanting to create distance between yourself and something means having an idea of the place where yourself ends. If you're trying to dodge a rattlesnake's lunge, you have a very precise conception of the space that you don't want the rattlesnake to reach, the space defined by your skin. So either way, whether tanha is driving attraction or aversion, it entails defining the realm of self. As Al-Bukhari has written, emotions involving tanha seem to point to, as a part of their content, an unspoken boundary between the identified as self on one hand and the desired or undesired scenario on the other, as it is perceived or imagined by the witnessing subject. Thus, tanha will not only indicate but also help create and drive the sense of self-other boundedness, and vice versa. The more clearly and deeply you feel that boundedness, the more tanha you'll be inclined to have. For unless I identified fully as a self, then how could I care particularly about whether my desires are fulfilled? So, you may be asking, what is the relevance of all this to the zapping of my wrath toward the snoring man? I might have asked the same question had I not gone back and reviewed the notes I took shortly after the zapping. It turns out that the version of the episode I just recounted is incomplete. It's the version I wrote from memory before going back and reading those notes. It leaves out some important details. For starters, right before this morning meditation session, there had been a short talk by Narayan, one of the two retreat leaders. Her theme was acceptance, learning to accept conditions you're inclined to find unpleasant. So, after spending a little time finding the snoring unpleasant, I decided to practice what Narayan preached and try to overcome my aversion to the snoring, which meant, of course, observing the aversion mindfully. As I put it in my notes later that day, I tried feeling my aversion and anger, which I could definitely feel and locate, in a neutral way. Then, basically, the feeling just disappeared as I accepted the snoring. So really, there were two intertwined feelings that I observed mindfully: the wrath toward the snorer and the aversion to his snoring. And when you overcome aversion, you are, by al-Bahari's logic, approaching the exterior version of the not-self experience more fully and directly than when you just overcome wrath.